I placed one dripping blanket under me and pulled the other over me. It was warm. It was sodden, but it was snug. It was wet, but it was warm. It was miserable, but it made me laugh. See me now, if you will, and you will see the war in the Pacific. Look at the ridge, rearing like a whale from the wild and dark green jungle sea. Sweep that tan hillside with your eye and search for a sign of life. You will see none. You will see only the gray rain falling, the rain and a cot and a solitary man huddling beneath a blanket. Ah, but he's happy. He and only he in all the world knows of the warmth within a wet blanket. Runner came down with malaria. They kept him at the battalion aid station for a few days and then sent him back to the lines. He was still feverish, but there was nothing they could do for him. He lay in his hole, unable to eat. When the chills came, we piled our blankets on top of him. When the fever broke and the sweat began pouring off him, he lay back and grinned. He could barely talk, but he whispered, "It feels so good. It feels so good. So nice and cool." In mid-November, we knew that the crisis had come. Our division had thrown back the Japs time after time, even gone on occasional offensive. We had hung on against stiff odds until the battle seemed to be even. But crisis was unmistakable in mid-November. It was in the air, a part of the atmosphere. Just as a man might sense a hostile presence in the dark, we felt the thing coming against us, the great Japanese task force moving down from the north. If it succeeded, we would all go down. But crisis never comes without being preceded by false optimism. So, too, was our crisis heralded by the appearance in the bay of a flotilla which sailed so gaily in, it seemed certainly to be the long-awaited reinforcements.
"Cripes!"
Skarchin shouted. Even his aplomb shattered.
"The Navy's come! The Navy's back! Look in the channel! Look! Look! A cruiser and three destroyers!"
We pelted up the hillside to the ridge crest, whence unfolded the vast panorama of northern Guadalcanal, the sea and the surrounding islands. From this distance, the channel seemed but a blue lagoon. But there were the warships. We hugged each other and danced. Chuckler, Runner, Hoosier, Oakstump, all of us. We strained our eyes for a glimpse of the transports. They were not in sight yet. Then came the question. Who says they're ours? Silence. The ship's guns gave answer. They were firing on our island. Here in broad daylight, arrogant, armed with a contempt more formidable even than their guns, they hurled salvo after salvo into the airport, sank the few small craft we had in sight, executed a sweeping about-face in the channel, and departed the way they had come, their stems dug into the boiling water as derisively as a woman flouncing her skirts. Chagrin. Not even our malodorous vocabulary could command a word base enough to express our vexation, our bitter exasperation, our cursing, foaming disappointment. Back we went down the hill and spent the rest of the afternoon trying to make light of it, desperately trying to release the pressure being generated by this new dread which no one dared to name. No one seemed to want to go to bed that night. Even though it was dark, all stayed hunched around Chuckler's pit, groping for the cheerfulness of the bright nights when we would stage impromptu vaudeville, trying to force a gaiety that was not there. At last, all crept to their holes. The naval battle awoke us. The voice of the imperturbable Skarchin came roaring out of the black.
"Cripes, it's a naval battle! You can see it! Come on, you jerks! Come on up here!"
I think of Judgment Day. I think of Götterdämmerung. I think of the stars exploding, of the planets going off like fireworks, of a volcano. I think of a roaring and an energy unbelievable. I think of Holocaust, and again, I think of night reeling from a thousand scarlet slashes, and I see the red eye of hell winking in her wounds. I think of all of these, and I cannot tell you what I have seen, the terrible spectacle I witnessed from that hillside. The star shells rose, terrible and red. Giant tracers flashed across the night in orange arches. Sometimes we would duck, thinking they were coming at us, though they were miles away, The sea seemed a sheet of polished obsidian, on which the warship seemed to have been dropped and been immobilized, centered amid concentric circles like shockwaves that form around a stone dropped in mud. Our island trembled to the sound of their mighty voices. A pinpoint of light appears in the middle of the blackness. It grows and grows until it illuminates the entire world, and we are bathed in pale and yellow light, and there comes a terrible, terrible rocking roar, and there is a momentary clutching fear to feel Guadalcanal shift beneath us, to feel our ridge quiver as though the great whale had been harpooned, as though the iron had smacked into the wet flesh. Some great ship had exploded. We could not even guess what or whose. We had only to lie on our hillside, breathless, watching until the battle was done, and then to retire to the pits to await dawn with murmuring voices and beating hearts. Were the result not so vital, we would have seemed like baseball fans anxious for the World Series scores. It was the beating of many motors on the airport that told us we had won. From the moment of dawn, the airplanes rose from the airport in pursuit of the enemy fleet. The sound of their motors was as triumphant as the march from Aida, and we cheered and jigged and waved our arms at them passing overhead, urging them on, shouting encouragement, beseeching them for direct hits to blast the Nipponese armada from the surface of the sea. It was electrifying. The noise of the airplanes was never absent from the air above our heads. They came and went all day, even the most decrepit among them, and we never tired of saluting them. All Guadalcanal was alive with hope and vibrant with the scent of victory. We were as doomed men from whose ankles the iron bands had been struck. A great weight was lifted from our shoulders. The enemy was running, the siege was broken, and all through the day, like a mighty Te Deum rising to heaven, came the beat of the airplane motors. Oh, how sweet the air I breathed that day! How fresh and clean and sprightly the life that leapt in my veins! To be delivered is to be born anew. It was as though we were putting aside our old selves, leaving those melancholy beings behind like a pile of soiled and crumpled clothing, exchanging them for newer persons, for the garb of gaiety and hope. So the tide turned on Guadalcanal. Chuckler found a scorpion in his clothes box, a canned soup crate which he kept in his hole. "Hey, Luck," he shouted. "I got a scorpion in my box. Come here." I gazed at the crabbed creature with its fearsome tail. "Let's see if they really commit suicide." Chuckler found a stone. He struck the bottom of the box sharply with it, driving the scorpion into a corner. His last blow struck perhaps a quarter inch from the cowering scorpion's body. We waited. We watched in fascination as the tail quivered, came slowly aloft, arched over and plunged into the scorpion's back. It seemed to be convulsed, then to lie still, dead. "I'm a son of a bitch," Chuckler ejaculated, releasing his pent-up breath. "How do you like that?" He was for overturning the box and emptying out the dead scorpion, but I suggested we wait a few minutes to be sure. We withdrew to squat on the hillside. In 5 minutes we returned. The scorpion was gone. "I'm a son of a bitch," Chuckler said again, this time in exasperation. "You can't trust nobody. Even the scorpion's a phony." 6. Chuckler and I began to forage for the platoon. Lieutenant Ivy League set us free, like bird dogs, and each day we buckled our pistols over the sun-bleached trousers which we had cut off above the knee, slipped empty packs over our shoulders, secured our helmets, and departed from the ridge. We had to make the descent on foot, but once we had gained the fields and the coastal coconut groves, we were able to hitchhike. Our destination was the food dump, set up not far from our first defensive positions on the beach. Food had begun to enter Guadalcanal in abundance after the defeat of the Japanese naval force, but in the manner of distribution characteristic of every army since Agamemnon's, it had not even begun to reach the frontline troops. It was being funneled into the galleys and the bellies of the headquarters units, and all the other rear echelons quartered safely behind the lines. Those are feats who are at once the envy and the contempt of every front-line trooper whoever had recourse to sanitary stick and slit trench. We considered all this food ours. We considered it ours, whether it resided within the barbed wire enclosure of the food dump or in the store tents of the rear echelons. We would get it by stealth, by guile, or by force. We would steal it. We would beg for it. We would lie for it. At first, when Chuckler and I would drop off the tailgate of the truck on which we had hitched a ride, we would approach the heavily guarded food dump by crawling on our bellies. Once close to the fence, out of sight by the army guards who sat atop the piles of cases, rifles over their knees, we would scoop out the dirt under the fence and squirm under. Stacks of crates and cartons gave us cover while we crept quietly along, searching for canned fruit, baked beans, spaghetti, Vienna sausage, even, prize of all prizes, Spam. Yes, Spam. Perhaps the processed pork that everyone called Spam was the bane of the stateside mess halls, but on Guadalcanal, Spam was a distinct delicacy. Often we would risk a bullet in the back for Spam, softly looting a case of it at the foot of the very stack upon which the sentry sat, like mice filching cheese from between the paws of a sleeping cat. Soon we had no need of stealth. The food dump had become the most popular place on the island. The roads became clogged with plunderers like ourselves, pistols swinging at their hips or rifles slung over shoulders, converging outside the fence like a holiday crowd outside of Yankee Stadium. There were now so many holes dug beneath the fence that one might gain entry at any point. Inside, bearded, gaunt, raggedy-ass Marines roved boldly over the premises, attacking the cases with gusto, tearing them open to seize what they wanted, leaving the rejected articles exposed to wind and sun with the indifference of pack rats. When a man's bag was full, he sauntered off, contemptuous of challenge from the guards. Inevitably, such a swarm of thieves depleted the dump and thus brought on more stringent security. We shifted to the ships. Friendly vessels riding at anchor had become a common sight in our channel since the naval battle. We hoped to exchange that marine commodity, tale-telling, for cups of delicious Navy coffee, and perhaps even for candy bars. We would wait until a boat had been emptied, before approaching its coxswain.
Hey, sailor, how about a ride out to your ship?
No insolence here. We played the childlike warrior begging a simple pleasure, the poor little match girl outside the candy shop on Christmas Eve. We played on the sailor's sympathy, inducing them to overlook the very plain law forbidding Marines to visit the ships. We cared for no law ourselves. What could the punishment be? But the sailors had to be persuaded, as did the officers of the deck once the landing craft swung under the ship's beam and we called up our request to come aboard. Often he shouted down in anger,
"No! Coxswain, take those Marines back to the beach! You know it's against regulations to bring troops aboard. Shove off, you hear me?"
"But, sir, I just wanted to come aboard to see a friend of mine, from my hometown. Wouldn't it be okay if my buddy and me came aboard to see my friend? We live next door to each other. He's my best friend, and I haven't seen him since the war started. He was with my grandmother when she died."
All depended now on the officer's acumen, or his willingness to be taken in. Should he ask for the friend's name, all was lost. Should he be stupid and believe us? Or should he fall into the spirit of the thing and grin at our obvious fabrication, we would grasp the rope ladder and climb aboard. Once gaining the run of the ship, we would trade our tails for coffee, our souvenirs for food and candy. A coterie forms quickly about us in the galley. We are the cynosure.
"You mean them Japs really was hopped up when they charged you?"
a sailor asks, refilling outstretched coffee mugs.
"Sure," comes the answer. "We found dope on them. They all had needles and packages of dope. They'd hop themselves up before the charge, and then they'd come at you bonsaiing."
No drugs were found on the Japanese.
"Did Marines really cut off their ears?"
"Oh, hell yes. I knew one fellow had a collection of them. Got most of them at the Battle of Hell's Point. The Teneru, you know? He hung them out on a line to dry out. The dope and the rain rotted them all away. Rained like hell one night and ruined the whole bunch. You wouldn't believe it, but half of them Japs can speak English.
We was hollering into the jungle one night things like, Tojo eat garbage, and Hirohito's a son of a bitch, when all of a sudden this Jap voice comes floating up at us, and what do you think the bastard said? To hell with Babe Ruth! We bask in their laughter and extend our cups for more coffee. A particularly receptive ship might even unlock the ship's store in our honor, and we would return to the ridge, packs filled with candy bars, razor blades, bars of soap, toothbrushes, and sundry trophies of the hunt. Let it be admitted that we were not unselfish in division of the candy bars, for these we considered rightful tribute for the forager. We kept them to ourselves. One day, hearing that the 8th Marine Regiment, the Hollywood Marines, had reached our shores and that they had brought with them a PX, Chuckler and I girded for our greatest foray. There were two tents, and there were two sentries, each standing with rifle and fixed bayonet in front of a tent. Behind was thickest jungle. Oh, unguarded rear. Oh, defenseless rump. Did they think the jungle impenetrable? Did they count themselves safe with this paper posterior of theirs? Astonished, Chuckler and I withdrew to the nearby battery of long toms to take counsel. We looked at each other and exploded in delighted anticipation of the discomfiture of the 8th Marines. We made our plan. I was to enter the jungle to cut my way up to the rear of the bigger tent. I would have both our packs. After 15 minutes, Chuckler was to stroll back to the PX clearing to engage the guards in conversation. The moment I heard voices, I was to cut my way into the tent, fill the packs, and carry them back into the jungle. The cool murk of the jungle was to my liking, as I began to creep toward the tent. My stiletto was very sharp, and I had no difficulty sawing through the lianas and creepers blocking my path. It was the necessity for extreme caution that made my progress slow. I had to be careful not to disturb the birds or the crawling things, for fear they might betray me. I was sweating when I reached the rear of the tent. The handle of my knife was slippery. I heard voices and realized that I had been longer than had been anticipated. A thrill shot through me at the touch of the hot, coarse canvas. My stiletto slid through the drum-tight facade with an almost sensual glide. In a moment, I had cut an opening. It was close within the tent, and the odor of creosote filled my nostrils. I had to widen the opening to let in light and air. Cartons were stacked one upon another. I peered at the letters on their sides. They were mostly cigarettes. It was a joke. There were plenty of cigarettes on Guadalcanal, but there were other boxes, and soon my sweat-soaked eyes fell upon a carton of filled cookies. Without another glance at the remaining cases, spurred by the rising and falling voices of Chuckler and the sentry, I bent to the task of transferring the contents of one carton into the packs. Even as I worked, I had to quell the greed rising within me. "Go on," it said. "Take more. Carry it out into the jungle by the boxful." I hesitated, but then I decided to fit my larceny to my needs and resumed my work. When I had filled one pack, I rose to draw a cautious breath and to listen for the voices. Chuckler's deep laugh came floating through the canvas walls. I bent to the other pack, reassured. My eye fell upon a partially open carton. It contained boxes of cigars. If cookies were worth their weight in gold on Guadalcanal, then cigars were worth theirs in platinum. In value, cigars could be surpassed only by whiskey, and there was no whiskey on Guadalcanal. Neither had there been cigars. Until now. I had stumbled on what was probably the only store of them on the island. I was for emptying my pack of the cookies, until I saw that there were but 5 boxes of cigars, which would just fit into the other pack. Quickly, I stuffed them in, and then, arranging one pack on my back, and holding the other before me, I slipped from the heat and smell and tension of the tent into the cool and murk and relief of the jungle. Covering the packs of branches, I rejoined Chuckler. He grinned with delight when he saw me approaching.
"Hey! What the hell you doing down here?" he shouted. "I'll bet you're up to no good," he nudged the sentry. "Better watch him. He's one of them dead-end kids from Jersey. He'll steal you blind." He grinned at me again, and I could see the rash devil dancing in his eyes.
But the guard thought it not hilarious, and a certain nervous tightening of both mouth and rifle hand gave warning. That chuckler. It was not enough that we should put our heads in the lion's mouth, but we must tickle his throat as well. My answering chuckle was a hollow thing, and after a few moments, I had him by the arm and was leading him away. "You crazy bastard," I whispered when we had got a safe distance from the sentry. "You want to tip him off?" I shrugged hopelessly and we departed, to return softly about 2 hours later to retrieve our loot. We came back to bask in the adulation of the ridge. We shared the cookies with our buddies and kept the cigars for ourselves. For days afterward, our pits were visited by a stream of officers, and once even a major from the Marine Air Units, all seeking cigars, all smiling now at the jolly enlisted men, all full of fake camaraderie and falser promises. We gave them none. We knew that we were winning. We knew it from the moment the P-38s, the lightning fighters, appeared in our skies. They came in one day as we crouched in the ravine at Chow. Pistol Pete had crashed his desultory shells not far from us, only a few minutes before. All of us braced for flight when we heard the roar of their motors and, looking up, saw the gladsome sight of their twin tails streaking over the jungle roof. We cheered wildly, and when Pistol Pete's shells came screaming in again, we cursed him good-humoredly out of hope renewed. Going back to the ridge, where the others waited to be relieved for their turn at Chow, it was necessary to pass the stream which served as our washtub. Two men, Souvenirs and his scouting partner, the Redbeard who looked like Hell's Santa Claus, were washing there. They shouted at each other as they scrubbed their bodies. We stopped to listen, and Chuckler asked, "What the hell's going on?" Redbeard replied, "This simple tool thinks we've had it tougher here than the Marines on Wake Island." He glanced contemptuously at Souvenirs and then appealed to us. "How stupid can you get?" "What do you mean, stupid?" yelled Souvenirs. "Trouble with you old salts, you figure nobody's any good who came into the Corps after Pearl Harbor. How do you know about Wake, anyway? You weren't there. And I still say it was a picnic compared to this place." Redbeard was aghast. Even as he turned to let Souvenirs soap his back, he shrieked at him in fury, "Picnic? Don't talk like a man with a paper ass. Ah, blow it, I'll bet the newspapers say this place was twice as bad as Wake. How many times they get bombed there? Who cares? How many of them are left? They didn't all get killed. Most of them was taken prisoner. Did we ever surrender, huh? How about that?" Redbeard turned again, automatically reclaiming his soap from Souvenirs, hardly pausing to launch his counterattack. "Don't give me that bull about quitting. That's all I ever hear you boots whining about. At Wake, they said, 'Send us more Japs,' but you guys say, 'When do we go home?'" His lip curled over his beard, and he raised his voice mockingly. "When does Mama's boy go home to show the girls his pretty blue uniform?" So the battle raged. So it ended, as it always does unresolved. The Marine Corps is a fermenter. It is divided into two distinct camps, the old salts and the boots, who are forever warring. The old salt defending his past and his traditions against the furious assault of the boot, who is striving to exalt the present at the expense of the past, seeking to deflate the aplomb of the old salt by collapsing this puffed-up past upon which it reposes. But the boot will forever feel inferior to the old salt. He must always attack, for he has not the confidence of defense. The moment he ceases to slash at tradition with the bright saber of present deeds, the instant he restrains that impetuous sword hand, trusting instead to the calm eye of appraisal. Upon that change he passes over to the ranks of the old salts and ceases to be a boot forever. Youth rebels and age conserves. Between them they advance. The Marines will cease to win battles the moment either camp achieves clear-cut ascendancy. Awareness of this began to dawn upon me as we trudged back up the hill. I was grateful to Redbeard for having reminded us of the men at Wake, and I was confident that he, upon reflection, would lose some of his contempt for us. We were back at the pits when Hoosier broke the silence. "You think Souvenirs was right? What he said about the papers? About Guadalcanal being famous?" "Hell no," Chuckler laughed.
I bet we ain't even made the papers.
I don't know, Chuckler, the Hoosier said thoughtfully. I kind of think he was right myself. He turned to me. Hey, Lucky, you think maybe they'd give us a parade in New York? The answer came quickly from Chuckler, his eyes glittering at the thought of it.
Say, wouldn't that be something? That's not a bad idea, Hoosier. Think of all them babes lining the street.
He paused, and the familiar expression of good-natured disdain returned.
Ah, forget it. You know they ain't gonna give us no parade. They don't even know we're alive. Who the hell ever heard of Guadalcanal, anyway?
I'll bet they have, Hoosier returned, his calm bordering on the smug. I'll bet you were famous back home.
Well, I'll bet you ain't getting to parade in New York, Chuckler came back. If we're that famous, if we're that good, they'll be using us for the next one. We'll get to parade all right. Right up Main Street, Rabaul.
You can say that again, came the runner's gloomy second. He had been silent, biting a thumbnail to shreds. In an instant, he had brightened at the thought of the parade and turned to me, speaking in a voice muffled by his munching.
Supposing they do give us a parade, where'd it be, Lucky? Up Fifth Avenue?
No. You're thinking of St. Patrick's Day. That's where the Irish parade. Probably it'd be up Broadway, from the Battery.
Battery? The Hoosier exploded. What they gonna do, charge us up?
Chuckler nodded.
Everybody's gonna get charged up on good old New York firewater, right, Lucky?
Right? 30-day leave for all hands.
And two babes for every man, one white and one dark,
Hoosier broke in sulkily. I ain't gonna parade. The hell with them. I ain't parading for nobody. Soon as we get off the ship, I'm gonna break ranks and lose myself in the crowd.
Wouldn't that be something? Said the runner excitedly. Supposing we came off the ship and everybody broke ranks and melted into the crowd? They couldn't find you in a New York crowd. We'd all be gobbled up. Everybody'd be drunk, and they couldn't do anything to you. Everybody'd be drunk, even the officers.
Everyone fell dreamily silent, a quiet that was finally broken by the wistful voice of Hoosier.
I bet they do, Chuckler. I bet they give us a parade.
Two changes had been wrought. The skies of Guadalcanal had become American, and mail was coming through steadily. Both events improved our humor. So it was that a great ripple of mirth ran over the ridge upon the arrival of a letter from my father. I read the letter squatting on the hillside, my buttocks just above the wet ground. A torrential rain had fallen, filling the holes and pits in what seemed but a moment, subsiding suddenly and succeeded by an astonishing swarm of ant-like insects so thick that one had to close one's eyes and shield one's mouth from them. Their tiny carcasses covered the ground when they fell. It seemed that they lived but a minute after that rain. And so it was that I was careful not to soil my freshly washed pants in either mud or the myriad of dead insects.
Robert, my father wrote, your blue uniform is ready. Shall I send it to you?
Ah. There came to mind, swiftly and sharply, a set of marine dress blues. I saw that gorgeous raiment. I squatted, stuck up on our ridge like Stylites on his pole, surrounded by wilderness and wetness and the minute corpses of millions of ephemeral ants. I squatted, clothed only in trousers cut off at the knee and a pair of moccasins stolen from an army duffel bag, and I contemplated this vision of glory.
Robert, your blue uniform is ready. Shall I send it to you?
In an instant, it had caught the fancy of the ridge. Until we left the ridge, I was,
Lucky, the guy whose old man wants to send him a set of blues.
I would walk to Chow, and the men from the other pits would greet me with,
Hey, Lucky, where's your blues?
Or,
Hey, Lucky, your old man send you the blues yet?
My very approach was enough for smiles. As though each of them was envisioning the 1st Marine Division drawn up on our ridge, resplendent in dress blues with flags flying and bands playing, marching off into the jungle to do battle. There was no boisterousness, no guffaws, merely the smiles and the sallies and occasional rib-poking. As though the very quaintness of my father's proposal were a thing to be cherished, like a family joke,
A bit of whimsy to save one's sanity on this mad island of ours. Everyone thought my father a hell of a guy, and they often inquired after his health. Sergeant Dandy gave us the bad news. He had visited us the day before to take our measurements for new clothing, and the inference had been so encouraging that we had spent the night in happy speculation. We were sure it meant we were leaving Guadalcanal. The question was, for where? But Sergeant Dandy's nasal cracker whine shredded our happiness like a whip.
Stand by to move out in the morning. We moving out from the Matanikau in a new offensive. Get all your foul weather gear ready and be sure your guns is oiled and your ammunition belts dry. 8th Marines will be up to relieve us in the morning.
He stopped and we examined each other in silence. There was no pleasure on his straight-featured boy man's face. Not even a hint of malicious satisfaction at being the bearer of bad tidings. The heart of Sergeant Dandy was as heavy as anyone's.
Don't ask me what it's all about. Don't ask me no silly questions, just do what I told you.
He turned and left. After nearly 5 months, this. Runner had malaria. Brick barely stirred from the pit except at night. Hoosier and Oakstump were subject to long periods of depression. Red had long since left us. I had dysentery. Chuckler was irritable. All of us were emaciated and weakened beyond measure. But we were to move out on the attack. We could not move to Chow without gasping for breath. But we were to move on the enemy. We despaired. In the morning, we crouched by our guns and waited for the order to dismantle them and move out. It did not come. Nor did it come the next day. Or the next, and hope came creeping back, blushing, ashamed of her disloyal flight, but commending herself to us once more with the promise never again to desert the ramparts. Then one morning, the word came to move out. Sergeant Dandy gave it to us.
Leave the guns behind, he said. Take only your rifles and foul weather gear.
He grinned.
We're being relieved.
It was December 14th, 1942. We had been on the lines without relief since August 7th. My battalion, the 2nd Battalion, 1st Regiment, was the last of those in the 1st Marine Division to come out of the lines. Guadalcanal was over. We had won. We came clanking down from the ridge in a chill drizzle, while the men of the 8th Marine Regiment came clamoring up. They wore Kelly helmets, the kind which our fathers wore in the First World War, and which the British still wear. They looked miserable, plodding up the slippery ridge in the drizzle. We pitied them, even though all the worst was past. But we could not resist needling them, these men from San Diego and sunny California.
Here come the Hollywood Marines! Yeah, will you look who's here? If it ain't the Pokey Bait Marines! Where's your PX, boys? Ah, blow it.
Will you listen to them talk? That ain't the way they do it in the movies. Shame on you.
Hey, what's the latest from Hollywood? How's Lana?
Yeah, that's it. How's Lana? How's Lana Turner?
They tried to appear disgusted, but they could not conceal the awe with which the reliever must inevitably regard the relieved. We went down the ridge, haggard but happy. They came up it, full-fleshed but with forebodings. I have said we were happy. We were. We were delirious. The next week we spent beneath an improvised tent on a hillside, where the ridges meander down to the Kunai fields. Chuckler and I visiting and revisiting the food dumps until we had collected so much food that I could afford to devour a gallon can of preserved apricots, making myself wonderfully, wonderfully sick to my stomach. I lay on my belly and felt the stretching pain and marveled. I'm sick. I ate too much. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. I ate too much. Only desultory visits from Washing Machine Charlie served to remind us that the Japanese were still contesting Guadalcanal. The following week was spent in a Garden of Eden. We marched to the mouth of the Lunga River to a tent encampment in a grove of coconuts. They gave us a ration of beer. Somehow we managed to gather enough of it to get mildly drunk every night. During the day, we swam in the Lunga, that marvelous river whose cold, swift waters kept the malarial fire out of my blood. Swimming was often hazardous, due to the wags who delighted in throwing hand grenades into the water. Once I heard a mighty shout out on the seashore, and running over, was astonished to see the giant stingray which some men had trapped in a native fishing net. Of course it was dead, punctured in 1,000 pieces by having offered 1,000 trigger-happy men the opportunity to get their gun off. Then we were sleeping alongside a road, waiting to embark the next day. On that day, they brought us our Christmas packages from home. We could not take them aboard ship with us, for we were not allowed to carry more than our packs and weapons. Chuckler and I had already asked Lieutenant Ivy League to carry our remaining boxes of cigars in his sea bag. Officers would be permitted to carry sea bags. It puzzled us to see the reappearance of sea bags, strictly the issue of enlisted men, and it angered us to see them handed out to officers. This was the first piece of discrimination which we encountered, the first flip of the single-sided coin, whereby the officers would satisfy their covetousness by forbidding us things rightfully ours, and then take them up themselves, much as politicians use the courts to gain their ends. So we devoured what we could of these Christmas gifts from home, and threw the rest away.
"Stand by to move out! Forward, hutch!"
We ambled down to the beach, our gait, our bearded, tattered aspect unable to match the precision of that command. We clambered into the waiting boats. We stood at the gunwales and watched the receding shoreline. Our boat putt-putted to a wallowing halt beneath a huge ship that listed so markedly to port that it seemed drunk. It was one of the old Dollar Line ships, the President Wilson, I believe.
"Climb up them cargo nets!"
As we had come, so did we leave. We were so weak that many of us could not make the climb. Some fell into the water, pack, rifle, and all, and had to be fished out. Others clung desperately to the nets, panting, fearful to move lest the last ounce of strength depart them too, and the sea receive them. These also had to be rescued by nimble sailors swarming down the nets. I was able to reach the top of the net, but could go no farther. I could not muster the strength to swing over the gunwale, and I hung there, breathing heavily, the ship's hot side swaying away from me in the swells, very perdition lapping beneath me, until 2 sailors grabbed me under the armpits and pulled me over. I fell with a clatter among the others who had been so brought aboard, and I lay with my cheek pressed against the warm, grimy deck, my heart beating rapidly, not from this exertion, but from happiness. Once below decks, Chuckler and I set out for the galley and the cup of hot coffee and conversation. We walked in and sat down, just as the last soldier who had been aboard this transport was rising to leave. He looked down at us as we sipped the coffee from thick white mugs.
"How was it?" he said, jerking his head shoreward.
"Rough," we answered mechanically. Then Chuckler spoke up.
"You mean Guadalcanal?"
The soldier seemed surprised.
"Of course I do."
Chuckler hastened to explain.
"I wasn't being wise. I meant, had you ever heard of the place before you got here?"
His astonishment startled us. An idea was dawning, gladly.
"You mean?"
"Hell yes, Guadalcanal, the first Marines. Everybody's heard of it. You guys are famous. You guys are heroes back home."
We did not see him leave, for we had both looked away quickly, each embarrassed by the quick tears. They had not forgotten. Chapter 4 Lotus Eater 1 The glory was gone out of it now. Gone was Guadalcanal. Gone was the valor, the doggedness, the willingness to let the jungle pick our whitened bones. We were spent. Fit only for the great debauch, stretching gaudily ahead in Melbourne. Say a requiem for camaraderie. mourn the departed fellowship that had bound us, officers and men, from the Carolina coastal marsh to the last panting lunge over the side of the President Wilson. It was dead. They took us first to Espiritu Santo, in the New Hebrides, where we arrived on Christmas Eve, each to receive a lollipop from the chaplain, while Lieutenant Ivy Lee gladdened the hearts of his superior officers with our cigars. And there, for 3 weeks, they gave us the manual of arms and practiced that portion of their code which admonishes the officers to remember that as he would not mistreat his dog, so he should not abuse his enlisted men. Then they took us to Australia. A happily blaring band played us onto the docks at Melbourne. It was our first sight of the land down under, for we had been below deck since leaving Espiritu, driven there by a filthy storm in the Tasman Sea. We grinned at the band, and suddenly every one of us knew it was going to be all right. I passed a red-haired waif and exchanged smiles with her, detecting in her gladsome eye a second hint of the good times to come. They bundled us onto a train and got us rolling. We crowded to the windows. Then everyone began to shout and whoop, for the most astonishing thing was happening. The route was lined with women, cheering, hugging themselves and each other, dancing up and down, blowing kisses, extending to the United States 1st Marine Division the fairest welcome. The train halted at Richmond, a suburb of the city, and we were herded into a fenced compound reminiscent of a cattle pen. On the other side of the fence were more girls, squealing, giggling, waving handkerchiefs, thrusting hands through the fence to touch us. Suddenly we were beside ourselves. We had not seen a woman since New Zealand, 7 months before. Then they opened the gate.
Company, attention! Fall hot!
We stepped out grinning, slouching, our rifles slung, right past the girls. In all that moving column of faded light green, there was nothing to suggest the military. So were born the Lotus Eaters. We were mildly surprised to find ourselves marching into a stadium. It was the Melbourne Cricket Grounds. Here were our quarters, double-decked bunks stretching up the cement steps in tiers. They had removed the benches, replacing them with our bunks, so that the effect was one of a huge horseshoe, from which sprang row on row of thin, spidery structures, and this enclosing a large circular green field. We were to live out of our packs. We slept in the open, unprotected save by a sort of quarter roof above us. Rain whipped by winds to our exposed front would not fail to wet us. But who was to complain? Still less, who was to care about such trivial inconvenience on this first day of our return to civilization? Who would upbraid the unadulterated good fortune which had quartered us in the cricket grounds, almost in the heart of the city, while the other regiments, the 5th, 7th, and the 11th Artillery, sulked in the suburbs? The city was ours, to be tasted almost nightly. We had not earned it. We had rather won it. Our regimental commander had flipped the lucky coin with the chiefs of the 5th and 7th. Of all the regiments, ours, the 1st, was in the most advantageous position for the great debauch. Discipline, already dissolved in the delicious squeals of the girls, all but disappeared that night. We had received part of our 6 months' arrears of pay in Australian pounds, but we had been issued no clothing. We still wore our disheveled dungarees. Yet, perhaps a third of the regiment prowled the streets of Melbourne. I was out alone. Runner, Chuckler, Hoosier, and the rest were either on guard or unwilling to risk it. The exhilaration of that night! At first I thought that it was my strange uniform and deep sunburn that marked me out for curiosity, but soon I came to realize that there was something more. I was the deliverer in the land he has saved. The smiles and winks of the Melbourne crowds assured me of it. The street hawkers, too, with their pennants, "Good on you, Yank, you saved Australia," told me it was so. It was adulation and it was like a strong drink. I took it for a triumph, and soon regarded every smile as a salute, and every Melbourne girl as the fair reward of the sunburned deliverer. The 1st was Gwyn. We met in a milk bar.
Strange place for a Marine with every appetite athirst after 7 months of abstinence. But the pubs of Melbourne closed at 6 o'clock, and I did not know then that the hotels continued to serve drinks for a few hours thereafter. I had marked her the moment I entered the place, and had seen the interest in her eyes. But now, as I sat alongside of her and drank a milkshake, she feigned indifference. I did not know what to say. So I asked her the time. She glanced pointedly at the watch so plain on my wrist, at the clock above my head, and said, "You're a Yank, aren't you?" Her words could not have been more exciting if she had said, "Let's go up to my room," for it mattered only that she should speak to me. "Yes," I said. "We've just come from Guadalcanal." Her eyes went round as she answered, "Have you now? That must have been terrible." So it went. Polite words. Formal words. Words without meaning, but words alive with the call of sex. Words converging on the result, so that in the end, after stops at hotels here and there, it was as though her first remark actually had been, "Let's go up to my room." For that was where we went. There was the flickering light of a gas heater, and there was the bed, but no more. Gwen instructed her brash visitor in the inscrutable ways of women. There would be no bell-bottom trousers in her young life. There would be no Yankees bastard to insult her declining years. There would be nothing. Without there first being a ring on her finger. Pretending a gravity most difficult under the circumstances, I arose from that unrewarding couch and reinvested myself in my uniform and my dignity. And I left. I closed the front door softly behind me and stepped into the silent night, ruefully reflecting on the American motion picture that has persuaded the world that all Yankee males are millionaires, cursing the conceit of womankind that is convinced there is no man living who cannot be bamboozled. Back in the center of Melbourne, outside the Flinders Street station, the streets were moving with Marines. If a third of our regiment had been illicitly ashore earlier, now it must have been half. Some were still bearded. It was a motley, reminiscent of that horde that had swarmed from the Guadalcanal jungle to fall upon the packs of the Dog Faces. This time, they brandished bottles. Hot dogs of the thick sausage-like Australian kind, meat pies, dishes of icy cream, whatever, could be obtained from the all-night kiosks. There was singing, too. It seemed that overnight, everyone had learned at least 2 verses of Waltzing Matilda. Once a jolly swag man camped by a billabong, under the shade of a coolabah tree. And he sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled, "You'll come a-waltzing, Matilda, with me." I had enough money left to hire a horse and carriage that stood by the railroad station, and half a dozen of us piled aboard. I slipped forward and rode the horse. So we came home, munching the delicious kiosk provender, pulling at the bottles and roaring with song, while the huge tame beast beneath me clop-clopped amiably along the pavement. Next day we drank to the death of discipline. We drank to it literally, for every pack had blossomed with a bottle, and with our feet on the corpse, for only one formation disturbed the orgy of the ensuing week. My memory of that reveille was that it was a delectable farce.
"Everybody up! Everybody out!"
A drink-thick voice of authority bellowed that morning. Silence. Then, like the dead stepping from open graves, perhaps a dozen of our 200 sleeping figures rose mechanically from their cots and enshrouded themselves in their blankets. One or two bent to tug bottles from their packs before stumbling downstairs and out the gate to gather in front of the stadium wall. Old Gunny, the one who had embarrassed the major when Secretary Knox visited us in New River, came staggering out to call the roll. But he could not speak. He gazed stupidly at this handful of huddling mummies. Lieutenant Ivy League rolled out to receive the report. Gunny about-faced with grave deliberation. He saluted with fingers awry, as though sticky with glue. "All presion then accounted for," he said, and sank gently on his face. Ivy League examined him with mournful solemnity, half bent
as though to place a tender pat on Gunny's face. Then he looked owlishly at us and said, "Company dismissed." We returned to our sepulchres. After that, they let us run. Perhaps they let us run because the officers, from top to bottom, were just as eager to gamble. They paid us, outfitted us with new uniforms, including those green battle jackets which we wore 18 months before they gained the Eisenhower name. They instructed us as to where and when we could get our meals, and they reminded us that prophylaxis kits could be picked up at sickbay. Except for those detailed to guard duty, everyone was free from noon on. Even the guards found playmates. These, who often descended upon the officer of the day, requesting a Marine to go walking with, were derisively called weed monkeys after their habit of lying in the tall grass of Victoria Park surrounding the cricket grounds. The guards at the side gates and those outside on roving patrol were most favored by the weed monkeys, and soon it got to be a standing joke that for the first time in Marine Corps history, there were men volunteering for guard duty. But the weed monkeys made things easier for those of us who had stayed out too late. One had merely to circle the cricket grounds until one came upon a rifle leaning against the wall, mutely testifying to the guard's delinquent occupation elsewhere, and one had only to open his gate and slip in. Each day brought a new pleasure, a fresh discovery. We discovered Australian beer, which compares favorably with that delicious Japanese beer. We found the bars plentifully supplied with Scotch whiskey. We learned that a Sheila is a girl, a Cobber, a friend, that what was Bonzer was excellent, that Fair Dinkum was the equivalent of honest to goodness, and that the term Yank could fall from the Australian lips like a kiss or a curse. In the first week we came upon an upstairs restaurant on Swanston Street, and here we discovered sparkling hock. We had asked for champagne, but the waitress said there was none to be had. "We've got sparkling hock, though," she said in that Australian accent that is Cockney. "It's nearly the same." "Does it bubble?" asked Chuckler, motioning with his hands. "You know, like ginger ale?" Chuckler would explain spaghetti to an Italian mama. The waitress grinned indulgently. "You Yanks," she said, and departed, returning with an ice bucket and bottle. The cork popped like champagne, and the fluid sparkled like it tasted like it. For as long as our money lasted, we had found our beverage. Chuckler and I clinked glasses with the exaggerated gravity of Hollywood. "To hell with war," he said. "Me for peace," said I. We finished the bottle, and innumerable others thereafter, along with innumerable meals of Australian steak and eggs, for the place became our headquarters. Here we dined most of our girls, and here we met Hope and Molly. Hope was possessed of that large beauty that has won many a Hollywood fortune, large oval face with fine silken brown hair falling round it. Wide-eyed and wide-mouthed, a straight nose, a fine-featured face, but a face empty, in repose, grasping. She was buxom, too. Hope was a classic, the classic barmaid, the sort whose broad behind has left a lasting imprint on the pages of history. She took to the dynamic Chuckler immediately, and was his girl until we left Australia. Hope never liked me. She thought me conceited and haughty. "Posh," she called me. Molly was different. In the days afterward, she was fond of slipping away from Chuckler and Hope, and then we would walk in the park, singing and teasing one another. She knew from the beginning where our friendship would end. She had not, like Hope, any thought of a life of ease in the bountiful United States. Her interest in me and the other Marines she dated was warm and human. For ourselves as persons, not for ourselves as futures. Poor Molly. She loved much. Too much. "Tell me of America," she would plead, while we walked the park paths, our feet crunching softly in the cinders, the night air a caress on the cheek, our arms interlocked. For that place, for that moment in love, I would tell her.
Sitting on a bench, I would tell her, or perhaps lying beside a lake while the breathtaking southern sky curved vastly away in a velvety star-dusted night. The fragrance of the flowering gum trees suffused that delicate evening.
Oh, Luck, I hope they'll never make you go back.
Me too.
But they will, won't they?
Don't worry about it, Molly. There's nothing we can do about it. It's the war.
Yes, but without it, we would never have met. You can thank the war for that, anyway.
Soon the mood would pass, and she would be jesting.
Aw, you Yanks! You're full of the blarney. All that sweet talk and the fine manners. And there's only one thing you're all after.
We would rise and swing, arm in arm, along the path, racing each other sometimes, at other times singing. Molly liked my voice. God bless her. The only woman, the only person who ever has. She thought I could sing, or maybe she only said she did to get me to sing the American swing song she loved. But Molly could sing, with a fine, clear pitch she could. There was one that was my favorite, a lilting little thing she'd sing in a soft, low voice as we walked home. Patrick, Michael, Francis O'Brien would never stop crying for sweet Molly O. Each morning, up with the sparrow, as swift as an arrow just leaving the bow, into her garden he'd wing, under her window he'd sing, "Sweet Molly O'Donohue, it's yourself that I'm asking to go for a bit of a walk." But Molly and I quarreled over another girl, and we drifted apart, even though Chuckler stayed close to his hope. Sheila had caused the breakup between Molly and me. I met her on a tram, as Chuckler and I rode to St. Kilda, an Australian beach resort outside of Melbourne similar to Coney Island, but not so blaring, not so much a honky-tonk. At the end of the line, the bus lurched and Sheila fell backwards into my lap. I imprisoned her with my knees and said, "Get up, please."
"I can't get up," she said, laughing.
"Aren't you ashamed of yourself?" I whispered into her ear. "Australian girls are so forward."
"Please,"
she said, giggling, turning her dark head to look at me.
"Please let me go."
I looked at Chuckler.
"What's she talking about, Chuck? Let her go. She can get up, can't she?"
He nodded gravely. "She likes it there." Sheila cast him an indignant look and said in a strained voice,
"Let me go, please."
"All right," I said, "if you go into Luna Park with me." She pursed her lips, then said, "Righto." "Good," I said, and relaxed my knees. Sheila got to her feet. She introduced herself and another girl, and the four of us went into Luna Park together. We went home together, too, taking the long train ride to one of the far-lying suburbs, and Sheila put both Chuckler and me up for the night in her mother's home. Chuckler stayed in a room in the house, but I was given an outlying cottage to sleep in. Actually, it may have been a stable at one time, for Sheila called the backyard the paddock. A walk connected it with the house about 50 feet away. The mattress was soft and lumpy, but the sheets were cool and clean-smelling. I dropped off to sleep. A noise aroused me, and I looked up to see Sheila closing the door. She turned and came toward me, holding a candle. She wore a nightgown.
"Hello, Yank," she said with a soft gaiety. "How do you like it in the paddock?"
I propped myself up on an elbow and nodded my answer. She sank to her knees beside the bed and looked into my face with laughing eyes.
"I'm fond of you, Yank. I hope you'll be coming up to see me often."
I looked at her, and she leaned closer and said, "Anything you want me to do for you?" I looked at her, and she blew out the candle. I saw Sheila every chance I had for about a month, sometimes dining at our headquarters, sometimes going to a dance, sometimes taking long walks about the lovely town she lived in, where the wattle grew bright on the hill. Sometimes drinking endless cups of tea in her parlor to moisten a throat gone dry with the tellings of tales of America to her lame and widowed mother. Not till the end of this time, till she told me that she was going to Tasmania, did Sheila tell me that she was married. After Molly and Sheila, no more affection. Only the chase. How does it go? How should I know? I am not a Casanova, nor is this a textbook for the amorous. It is cold, yes. It is calculating, of course. But a man should not risk involvement when satisfying lust. He must never be romantic. He must leave romantic love to the unrequited poets who invented it.